A month or so ago, I shared with you that after my annual physical earlier this year, when the lab results came back from the blood draw, it indicated that I am now just, my A1C is now just, which is blood sugar, is just 0.1% below an official diabetes diagnosis. Now, I know what you're thinking. How can someone that skinny have high blood sugar? All I can say is life is not fair, right? But receiving that news, I decided, okay, I've got to get serious about making some dietary changes. And so to guide me in that process, I purchased a kit for one of these 30-day continuous glucose meters that you put on the back of your arm that pairs with your phone and gives you real-time readings of your blood sugar level, so that as you eat different kinds of food, you can figure out what causes my blood sugar to spike. Boy, was I surprised at the things that were causing the spikes. It's not what I would have thought. Guess what was a part of my routine diet that was spiking my blood sugar more than anything else? Not cookies, not coffee, not bananas, not bologna. It turns out it was pinto beans, a super health food. I would routinely, a couple times a week, eat some pinto beans at lunch, and boy, most people don't respond that way to pinto beans, but my system did. We all respond differently to different foods. You know what else was spiking my blood sugar? Another super healthy food, a bowl of oatmeal, rolled oats, in the morning. So I started making some changes in my diet, and happy to say that, at least according to my glucose meter, I'm now back in the normal sugar range, even the pre-diabetes range, which makes me very happy. But it's surprising what I was learning through that process. I also, during this process of discovery, went on to a diabetes site because I love salads, eat a lot of salads, and I like sweet dressing. So I started researching, looking for a sweet dressing that won't spike my blood sugar. And I found one on a diabetes site that has zero impact on blood sugar, and it's so sweet, it is so good. I'm kind of embarrassed to tell you the name of it, because it's kind of a funny name. But the name of this salad dressing is Skinny Girl Raspberry Vinaigrette. Because you know, I'm just a skinny girl, right? So here I am at Walmart walking down the salad dressing aisle, and there are all these svelte, fit young women in their workout tights who are grabbing the skinny girl bottles off the shelf. And then along comes this old codger me. Watch out, ladies. Give me one of them there bottles of Skinny Girl. It's good for what ails you. Another thing I discovered that was spiking my blood sugar, you'll never guess this one, is preaching. Because when you engage in a vigorous activity that causes adrenaline to flow, it causes your body to release glucose energy into your bloodstream. So, you also are bad for me. I always suspected it, but now I can prove it. You're killing me. Literally, you're killing me. Pleasure. The things I do for you, sacrificing for Jesus. But the point I'm getting to in a wordy, roundabout way is, in life, what we think is good for us often isn't. And what we think is bad for us sometimes is actually good. Life is often counterintuitive. Spiritual life is like that. That is also true of spiritual life. I am struck by how many of the truths Jesus taught us are completely counterintuitive. Today, as we come to the fourth installment in our sermon series on how to build beautiful relationships the Jesus way, we're going to explore one of those profoundly counterintuitive truths Jesus taught us about how we can build beautiful relationships in our life. I warn you that a few minutes into this sermon, you're going to be thinking, what does what he's saying have to do with building beautiful relationships? But if you'll stick with me, I think it will all come together, hang together as we move through this. Let's start with a prayer. Jesus, we know that life is people and people are life, which means we can't live the good life if our approach to relationships is wrong. Today, we open our hearts to a profoundly counterintuitive truth you want to teach us about how to build beautiful relationships and therefore how to build a beautiful life. Speak, Lord. We're listening. This we ask in your holy name. Amen. So the story of Alice in Wonderland is told in two classic books by Lewis Carroll, the second entitled Through the Looking Glass. Alice is sitting in the living room of her home when she passes through the looking glass, the mirror above the fireplace, into an alternate reality where everything is upside down. In Wonderland, it's mind-bending. In Wonderland, flowers can talk, and time moves backwards so that questions are answered before the question is even asked. In Wonderland, you receive birthday gifts, not on your birthday, but on your unbirthday. And in Wonderland, in order to get closer to an object, you often have to move away from it. So that Alice begins to question everything that she thought she knew. Spiritually speaking, Jesus invites us to step through the looking glass, as it were, into an alternative reality where everything is upside down. In other words, Jesus challenges us to dare to ask, is it possible that reality is very different from what I have perceived? That we humans, the typical instinctive way we see life is all wrong. Because as we make our way through the teachings of Jesus, again and again, Jesus is telling us up is down and down is up. In other words, Jesus is telling us radically counterintuitive things that run directly contrary to reality as we instinctively perceive it. For example, in Matthew 20:16, Jesus said, the last will be first and the first will be last. The reverse of our instinctive understanding. Elsewhere, Jesus said, it is more blessed to give than to receive. Elsewhere, whoever becomes humble like a child is greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And whoever tries to keep their life will lose it. But whoever loses their life will preserve it. Again and again, Jesus emphasizes to us that our typical human understanding of life misses so much of reality that reality, as we perceive it, we're off by 180 degrees. And as a result, most of humanity is moving in the wrong direction. 85-year-old Herman was driving down Highway 405 in California when his phone rings. It's his wife, Ellen. Ellen says, Herman, I've been watching the local news and they say there's a vehicle that's driving the wrong way down Highway 405. Be careful out there. Herman looks up and looks down the highway and says, Ellen, it's not just one vehicle, it's hundreds of them. In other words, Herman is the one driving the wrong way down the highway. But who's to say he's wrong and the hundreds are right? After all, people in Europe drive on the opposite side of the road. Truth is not determined by majority vote. The Bible puts it this way: there is a way that seems right to a person, but the end is the way of death. The CEB translation of that verse puts it even more vividly. It says, some people think they're doing what's right, but what they're doing will really kill them. Elon Musk is the wealthiest person in the world. In fact, after the SpaceX IPO, he recently became the first person in human history to be a trillionaire. Now, the share price of SpaceX has now gone back down a bit. So now he's only worth a mere $684 billion. Still, by far, the richest person in the world. Imagine $684 billion. He must be living large. Talk about the good life. He must be experiencing it, but not so fast. Elon Musk has been divorced 3 times. Has fathered 14 children by 4 different women. None of them live with him. Elon Musk, according to those who are closest to him, they describe his relationships as messy and full of, quote, psychological turmoil. Musk says he works 120 hours a week. How is that possible? And he hasn't taken a vacation for 25 years. We all know what Musk did last year through Doge, cutting off virtually all USAID dollars to the poorest of the poor, nutritional supplies and medicines. Nonpartisan studies since then have estimated that in the past year, as a result of that, 750,000 of the poorest of the poor have died, 500,000 of which are children. Imagine what it feels like to lay your head on the pillow at night knowing that you did that. I saw an interview recently where the interviewer asked him, how many people do you think have died because of what you did through Doge? Cutting the USAID money. He said, oh, zero. The questioner pressed him. She said, asked him again. He was emphatic, zero. Because you can't acknowledge that to yourself and sleep at night. But it has to be floating around in there, somewhere in the back of his mind. Those close to Musk say his behavior is erratic. He lives alone and told an interviewer he often feels lonely. Those who are close to him say he has a serious ketamine habit. He told an interviewer, I'm often not happy. His words, quote, often not happy. He compared his life to the interviewer as a video game. He says it's like being a video game addict, where achieving one level immediately turns into chasing the next. He says his work takes up so much time, he has no opportunity to pursue personal peace. So here's somebody who has everything, yet has nothing. But now let me introduce you to someone else, someone named Manoj Singh. Manoj is a rickshaw driver in the busy city streets of India where he lives. A thankless job, countless hours a day, extraordinarily strenuous physical activity, pulling people around the busy streets of his city through sweltering heat, monsoon rains, often verbally abused by drunken passengers, just to get to eke out a little bit of a living in a place where there's not a great deal of opportunity. He lives with his wife and 3 children in a 1-room corrugated tin hut that's held together by tarp. There's no running water. There's no sanitary. His children don't have access to quality education or to medical care. They often only scrape by eating salted rice. But when he was interviewed on a documentary called happiness, where sociologists were bringing together into a documentary the best science about what it is that makes people authentically happy as human beings. As he, Manoj Singh, was being interviewed, he looked into the camera, and with complete authenticity, he said, "I am not poor. I am the richest person." He acknowledged that he and his family's life is very hard, but he insisted, "Still, we are happy." Talk about counterintuitive. So we've got one guy who's the richest person in the world, yet has nothing. And another guy who's got nothing, yet has everything. Manoj, his life is hard. He's desperately poor, and yet supremely happy. While the other guy has everything, but is so desperate and empty, he keeps needing another hit of ketamine just to get through the night. Suppose you had a choice. Suppose God said to you, "You get to choose, you have to choose, to be either Elon Musk or Manoj Singh. And when you, whichever you choose to be, you can't change them. You have to be who they are in body, mind, and circumstance." If you had to make that choice, who would you choose to be? Near the end of the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus tells us that there are basically two paths of life that we humans get to choose between. One of these paths, he says, is wide and easy to access because it coincides with human instinct about what brings us happiness in life. And yet, Jesus says, that path leads nowhere. Meanwhile, Jesus says there's another path. He says it's a narrow path that is hard to access because it is so counterintuitive. But Jesus says that is the path that leads to life. In other words, to fullness of life. Jesus puts it this way in his own words, Matthew 7:13, "The gate is wide and the road is easy that leads to destruction, and there are many who take it." The vast majority of humanity is walking down that road. But Jesus says the gate is narrow and the road is hard that leads to life, and there are few who find it. What are these two different paths? Let's map them out as best we can understand it. The first path, the wide, easy access path, that coincides with our human instincts. That's why it's so easy to access it. It begins with what I would call indulgence. Now, indulgence often has a negative connotation. I don't mean it that way. I simply mean it as indulging in the pleasures of life. Yes, there are illegitimate pleasures, but there are also many legitimate pleasures in life, the gifts of life. Our natural instinct is to say, if I'm going to be happy, I have to indulge in, experience as many of these pleasurable experiences as possible, because that's what's going to make me feel good. That's what's going to make me happy. And it is true that these pleasurable experiences bring us happiness when we're experiencing them in the moment. But when the moment's over, so is the happiness. I call it a temporary sugar high, if you will. Pleasurable experiences in life can give us a temporary sugar high, but as soon as we come down off that sugar high, we need the next hit. For example, at home, every Christmas, my spouse makes a huge batch, some of you have experienced this, a huge batch of Paula Deen banana pudding. Picture chunks of banana in a creamy pudding with Pepperidge Farm Chessmen cookies broken up and sprinkled throughout, even better when they get soggy in the pudding, and then topped off with hot fudge sauce fresh off the stove. Talk about a sugar spike. Picture a bowl of that banana pudding drenched in hot fudge sauce. It's to die for. In fact, you eat enough of it, you will die. Once each Christmas, I allow myself one bowl of that banana pudding, and let me tell you, it's heaven. You cannot eat that banana pudding and not be happy until you get to the end and you're scraping the bottom of the bowl, or licking the bottom of the bowl, as the case may be, and everything inside of you says, that was great, but I need more. It's never enough. That's why this first road leads to nowhere. Yes, part of life, part of a healthy, balanced life is enjoy the pleasures of life. That's good. But if we're looking to that for our core happiness, it will disappoint us every time, because the happiness that comes from this path is temporary. It's circumstantial. It comes and it goes depending on what you're experiencing in life. Remember, a month or so ago, I was telling you about when I was a kid and the first time I rode a roller coaster at Kings Island. I was scared to death of the roller coasters when I was a kid. But I went to Kings Island with a friend who loved roller coasters, and I insisted we ride the floaty boats in Hanna-Barbera Land, but he kept insisting we go to the roller coaster, and so I finally relented. And about a quarter of the way through this roller coaster ride, I realized, this is great! Absolutely thrilling. It was an ecstatic experience. And when we rolled back in to the roller coaster station at the end of the ride, do you remember what I said to my friend Mike, what I turned to him and said at the end of the ride? Let's do that again. And again. And we did it about 5 times that day. Ecstatic when you're experiencing it, but as soon as it was over, so's the happiness until you get your next hit. That's the challenge. The Bible puts it graphically. It puts it this way. Hell and destruction are never full, so the eyes of humans are never satisfied. If the path that we're following to achieve happiness is the path of indulgence in pleasures that make us feel good, it will never be enough. It leads to nowhere. But, thankfully, there is that other path. The one that Jesus calls narrow and hard, but says leads to fullness of life. That path is anchored by what Jesus teaches us in the gospel passage that Phyllis read for us a few moments ago. The setting is the Last Supper, John chapter 13. It's the night before Jesus' crucifixion when he and his disciples gather for the feast of the Passover. As the disciples are gathering, none of them wants to be the one to wash the feet of the others. In that culture, in that time, a desert culture where people wore sandals or no shoes at all, walking around, your feet would get hot, they would get dusty and dirty, the skin would crack. And so it was a custom of hospitality at a formal dinner party. The host would designate someone, whoever was the person of lowest social status, usually a servant, to wash the feet of the guests as they arrived, because that was soothing, it was refreshing, it was an extravagant gesture of hospitality. But at this Last Supper, none of the disciples wants to be the one to be the, quote, servant that washes the feet of the other. And so Jesus himself gets up, gets a bowl of water and a towel, and he begins to wash the feet of his disciples. And when he comes to Simon Peter says, no, Lord, you will never wash my feet, because this was all wrong. Jesus was their leader. Their leader shouldn't be washing their feet. Jesus is the Son of God. You can't let the Son of God wash your feet. You should wash his feet. Peter says, no, Jesus, it'll never happen. You're not going to wash my feet. And Jesus said, unless you let me wash your feet, you have no part in me. In other words, if you're going to get me and what I all that I've been trying to teach you, Peter, you need to let me do this. So Peter relented. And when all was said and done, Jesus explained to them what he was trying to teach them through this. He had taught them this point many times in his ministry, but at the Last Supper, it was the last thing he came back to really drive home, because it is so core to what Jesus was trying to teach us. Jesus explains what he was trying to teach them in this foot washing this way. John 13:13, you call me teacher and Lord. You're right. That's who I am. So if I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I've set for you an example that you also should do as I have done. Very truly I tell you, servants are not greater than their master. If you know these things, you're blessed if you do them. Don't miss the significance of that last sentence. If you know these things, you are blessed if you do them. Jesus says, I am here to serve. And you, following my example, are now also here to serve the people around you. And Jesus is teaching us here that if you do that, if you live that way, you are blessed. The Greek word that is translated blessed there in the first century, that word makarios meant being supremely happy, a deep internal joy and contentment that is independent of circumstances. In first century Greco-Roman culture, that term makarios was often used to refer to and describe the happiness of the gods. Divine happiness, what we would call the joy of the Lord. So what Jesus is saying here is, if you want a transcendent happiness that's not dependent on your outer circumstances, if you want to experience the happiness of the gods, the joy of the Lord, the path that leads to that is service. Seeing your mission statement in life, your primary objective in life, to be serving the people around you. But that's a hard path. Because service means sacrifice, and sacrifice is hard. Why would anybody do that? Look what Jesus, what the Bible tells us about Jesus. Hebrews 12:2. Look to Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith, who, for the sake of the joy set before him, endured the cross, disregarding his shame, and has taken a seat at the right hand of the throne of God. Jesus' greatest act of service was the work he did for us on the cross, when he gave his life so that we might live. How, while Jesus was doing that, his experience on the cross, that was hell. That was hard. Jesus had to endure that. How did he endure that? What was it that enabled him to push through that? It was the joy set before him. He was practicing what he preached. He understood that if he poured out his life in service to us, that it would come back to him on eternal waves. Joy unspeakable and full of glory, because Jesus gave so much of himself. That creates significance in his life. Significance creates meaning, and meaning creates transcendent joy. Mr. Rogers summed it up by saying, life is for service. Say it with me. Life is for service. One more time. Life is for service. That is the path. Hard, but beautiful path that leads to beautiful relationships, and beautiful life. So this second path that Jesus traces out for us, I would call it the abundant life as opposed to the instinctive life. It begins with sacrificial service, which creates significance. It means my life is making a difference for others, and that gives my life meaning. And that leads to joy, Makarios, the happiness of the gods, the joy of the Lord. You want to be happy? You want to experience transcendent happiness that's independent of circumstances? That's the path. As we start to wind down, let me give two examples of what this way of life can look like when lived on the ground, at ground level, in a practical way. True story. Sarah Lundgren is a 61-year-old mother and grandmother. Her husband, who was the primary breadwinner in the family, passed away a number of years ago, and she now, in her home, she now cares for her children, including an adult autistic child, and their children. All told, she's got 8 hungry mouths to feed besides her own. She's stretched thin. They live in a small apartment. Life is tough for Sarah's family. But one day she promised her kids and grandkids, she said, this week I'm going to make a special meal for you all. So she goes to Walmart to gather groceries. When she's in the checkout line scanning her items, she pulls a couple packages of steaks out of her cart to scan them. But when she looks at the subtotal that's already on the screen, she realizes if I run these steaks through, I'm not going to be able to afford, I don't have enough money to cover this. In a split second, she said, on an impulse, I did something crazy and stupid. She thought about setting the stakes aside, and I just can't do this. But on an impulse, she went ahead and bagged them without scanning them. Somebody apparently noticed it on the camera, because as she and her autistic daughter were exiting the grocery store, she was pulled aside. The manager asked her to step into a room. Police officers were summoned, shoplifting. When Officer Wagner arrives on the scene, Sarah's autistic adult daughter is beside herself, thinking that her mom is going to be hauled away to prison. Sarah confesses to the officer what she did. She says, I've never done anything like this before. I don't know what came over me. She said, it's just that, I don't know. She says, sometimes when you're so worn out and you're so desperate, you do stupid and desperate things. But this was shoplifting, and after Officer Wagner had no choice but to write a citation compelling her to go to court to defend herself against the felony of shoplifting. So he wrote it up, handed her the citation. She was now free to go. When Officer Wagner gets back in his vehicle, does a background check on Sarah, he sees that she was telling the truth. She had no record. In fact, he said she had fewer traffic tickets than I did. And that's when the Spirit of God spoke to him. He had an idea. He drove to a nearby food pantry. He told the manager of the food pantry what had just happened. She summoned a group of her volunteers, and they proceeded to load his squad car with boxes and cans and fresh fruits and vegetables, and then he headed for Sarah's apartment. He phoned ahead, had her number from the police report, and said he was coming over. Sarah says, my first thought was he's going to take me away in handcuffs. But he told her, no, it's a surprise. It's a good surprise. When he got there, she came down to see what was going on, and she saw his vehicle stuffed to the gills with all this food. He said, this is for you and your kids. She was overwhelmed. Her knees almost buckled. She began to weep. And what she said to him was, no. Take it back. I don't deserve this. But he insisted. She eventually relented. She and the kids and the officer carried all the food up to their apartment. And the last thing he said to her was, God's given you a second chance. Make the most of it. What do that night when he laid his head on his pillow, how do you think it felt to be Officer Wagner? The joy of the Lord. Look what I was able to do today. Significance, meaning I made a significant, beautiful difference in the life of 9 hungry people. That's joy. I'll bet someday when Officer Wagner is on his deathbed, I'll bet he's still living off of that experience. I'll bet he's still remembering that. And the joy will be just as full as the moment that it was happening. And a billion years from now in eternity, he'll still be living on the high that comes from what he did for Sarah and her family. Because when we serve others, it creates significance. Significance creates meaning, and that is what gives us transcendent joy, the joy of the Lord, the joy that God experiences that can be ours. But Jesus, he doesn't gild the lily. He's very frank that that's a hard way to live, right? It's hard because service requires sacrifice. And let's face it, the people around us are messy. That coworker of yours is annoying. Your spouse probably does a number of things that makes you want to say, why do you always do that? Why do you have to be so annoying? And I'm supposed to serve you. You don't even pull your share of the weight. Hypothetically speaking. A man is sitting in the living room staring at his and his wife's marriage certificate. She walks into the living room and says, what are you doing? He says, oh, nothing. She says, don't tell me nothing. You've been staring at that certificate for 5 minutes. What are you doing? He said, looking for the expiration date. A woman is walking down the beach one day when she trips over a half-buried antique-looking lamp. She picks it up and dusts it off, and poof, a genie appears. The genie says, I hereby grant you one wish, whatever you ask for. She says, I thought genies were supposed to grant 3 wishes. He says, don't push your luck, lady. I'm old. You get one wish. Make it a good one. She thinks for a moment. Then she pulls out her phone, pulls up a map of the Middle East, points to the map and says to the genie, see these countries in the Middle East here? I want you to make peace for them. The genie says, good grief, lady. I'm powerful, but not that powerful. They've been fighting for thousands of years. No, can do. You got to pick something else. All right, she says. She thinks. Okay, she says, I know. My wish is I want you to fix my husband. I want you to make him the kind of person who pulls his weight evenly, who helps with the chores around the house, helps care for the kids, even Stephen, who doesn't throw his clothes on the floor and expect me to pick them up or leave his dirty dishes in the sink and expect me to rinse them. I want you to turn him into somebody who doesn't spend all of his time sitting on his butt watching sports on TV. The genie. Amen. The genie sighs deeply and says, hey, lady, show me that map again. It is not easy making our life's mission to serve others. But Jesus repeated it again and again in his ministry. And another time, another place, Jesus said to his disciples, whoever wishes to be greatest among you, you want a great life? Whoever wants to be greatest among you must be your servant. Just as I, Jesus, the Son of Man, came not to be served, but to serve and to give my life a ransom for many. Jesus set the pattern, and now he invites us to have enough faith to follow him. He doesn't gild the lily. Remember, he says, this road is hard, but it leads to life. Do we have enough faith to take it? Second and last practical example. Kevin Miller tells how when he was 11 years old, his dad surprised him with a fishing trip just the two of them, me and Dad. He was 11 years old. He said, this felt to me intuitively like a rite of passage. It's as if my dad was saying, I don't just now see you as my son, but also as my fishing buddy, as my friend. And Kevin says, I so wanted to live up to my father's expectations, to prove to be, you know, a big kid, a big person, instead of a little boy on this trip. So he says, I did everything I could to live up to the confidence that my dad was showing. They went to New Hampshire to the, I think it's called the Ossissippi River, and they stayed in a cabin there, fishing by day and the cabin by night. After a couple days of great fishing, the second night in the cabin, Kevin says, I woke up on my bunk bed in the middle of the night with a painfully upset stomach. I thought to myself, I feel like I'm going to throw up. But he said, the cabin was cold and it was so warm under the blankets, and the cabin was dark and scary. He says, I thought, no, it'll pass. I'm just going to stay here. Until suddenly he felt an urge he couldn't resist, and he ends up throwing up over the side of the top bunk onto the floor. He says the awful sound of the splattering of vomit against the plank wood floor. His father could hear it from the adjacent room. It awakened his father. His father opened the door, came into the room, flipped on the light, saw this terrible vomit mess. He says, his father said, Kevin, why couldn't you get to the restroom? Why didn't you get into the restroom? Kevin said, I'm sorry, Dad. And Kevin says, then I braced myself for the scolding, the tongue lashing I was about to get, and I knew I deserved it. I'd done something foolish and stupid. Worse yet, he says, it was childish. I had disappointed the confidence that my father had placed in me. So he says, I braced myself for the tongue lashing that I knew I deserved, except it never came. He says, my dad didn't say a word of scolding. He just walked out of the room, came back a minute later with a bucket of soapy water and a brush, got down on his hands and knees, and cleaned up my mess. Not with a woe is me attitude, not with a the things I do for you attitude, but he just did it in a positive spirit as I watched. Kevin says, a few months after that, my father unexpectedly died, leaving me with that indelible image of my dad on his hands and knees, serving. He says, it was a key formative moment in my life, a moment that still inspires Kevin in his life to live, to serve. That dad, short as his life was, lived with great significance and meaning because his life of service impacted his son's life, who now lives out of that same model. And a billion years from now, Kevin's dad will still be able to take joy from the example of service he set for his son. Do you want to be supremely happy? Do you want to experience the happiness of the gods, divine happiness? Jesus sums it up this way, John 15:11. I have said these things to you, why? So that my joy may be in you. Do you want to be as happy as Jesus was? I've said these things to you so that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be complete. Life is for service. Say it with me. Life is for service. One more time. Life is for service. It's hard, it's sacrificial, it's counterintuitive, but it leads to a joy that transcends the joy of the Lord. Let's follow Jesus down that road. Amen. Amen.